Campus FM presents 100 Years of Women on Campus, produced and presented by Patricia Camilleri. Welcome to this anniversary series, remembering 100 years of women on campus. I'm Patricia Camilleri, and I shall be looking at this theme from many different angles, the sociological, the statistical, the anthropological, and the historical. I shall be asking questions about life for female students and academics on and off campus, yesterday and today, and possibly also tomorrow. I'm very pleased to have with me in the studio today Professor Mary Darmanin. Just a few words about my guest. Professor Darmanin studied at the Universities of Malta, Essex and Wales, College of Cardiff. Her doctoral research was the first ethnographic study of Maltese schools. Professor Darmanin has had a long-standing interest in gender issues, in education and in women in the labour market. Her many publications include papers on the subject of gender equality within various educational contexts, attempts to take a radical approach within a conservative environment, and the influence of religion in Maltese primary schools, of topical interest given the multicultural environment in which these schools function today. In 2007, she was awarded a Marie Curie Transfer of Knowledge Fellowship, tenable at University College Dublin, Ireland, which I know was a lovely experience
yes,
for you.
Yes, it was.
She's currently working on the findings of the Malta Student-Teacher Relationship Project, a project of the National Institute for Childhood. Regarding the departments, and I mention this because we talk about Faculty of Education very often, and you know, somehow all the departments are conflated in
yes,
the name Faculty
yes,
of Education. Here I quote from the website, The members of our department continue to make education as their focus of study. This is done through various disciplines, particularly from a sociological, psychological, philosophical and historical dimension. We try to merge disciplinary knowledge and method to address particular educational issues. Welcome to you, Professor Darmanin.
Thank you.
This is the penultimate in the series, 100 Years of Women on Campus, and I have had the privilege to interview many different women, and also some men, on the subject of women in tertiary education. I have to say that I have learned an enormous amount from each and every one of the participants in this series. They have dispelled some preconceptions that, probably like many others, I had regarding women in tertiary education. Doing this series has pushed me into studying the early graduates further, getting to know them better.
Yes.
Their names should be known, and I
yes,
hope there
yes.
will be other occasions to say more about them. But today, having heard opinions and comments with a wide range of people, I'd like to pick your brains, Professor Darmanin.
Yeah.
Mary, if I may.
Mary, of course,
Mary. About some issues that have become almost a leitmotif throughout the programs. I thought we could look
yes.
at some of those repeated themes, drill down, see whether through your discipline of pedagogy and your sociological interests, they could be unpacked a bit.
Yes.
I'm sure that you have some ideas about some solutions to the issues at hand, and I look forward to hearing about them. Of course, the more radical and off the wall, the better.
So, very doable.
Yes,
very doable.
So perhaps just as a start off, we could say, you know, perhaps we could start off with a general comment about gender in education and then move into the various issues of interest.
Yes, well, research on gender shows how very context-bound gender identities are. So what I would be talking about today and how boys and girls acquire masculine or feminine identities and then through that learn, and also the context in which they learn, are constantly changing. And what I would say now would not be true in a different context. So, for example, what would work in Malta today might not work somewhere else. What would work today mightn't in 2 years' time, because gender as different from biological sex is socially constructed, and it has therefore a historical dimension, time, the time during which you are educated, what was considered appropriate for you to learn, how it was considered appropriate for you to learn, would be very much linked to the historical process. And so apart from that socially constructed, it would also be in relation to other factors. So for example, gender and social class is a very important theme. If we took the theme of girls currently in science, technology, engineering and mathematics, for example, what would we find? That it isn't only a question of achievement, but also of class, that middle class parents tend to push their daughters into careers, and because they push them into careers, they also push them into STEM careers, whereas working class parents tend to have different aspirations for their daughters. And therefore, the intersection between gender and class, gender and ethnicity, is an important one to consider. We also have to consider the school context. I mean, if you take countries like the previous Soviet bloc countries, Eastern Europe, they in the past had no gender disparities, neither in achievement nor in take-up. They had many females doing very, very well in the STEM subjects, for example. They had males in humanities. Why? Because they promoted a very equitable type of schooling. They were pro-gender equality, and they considered it appropriate for females to follow careers in science, engineering, etc. And as a result, they didn't get the same results we get, which is that females, even when they are highly achieving, tend to not take up. There's a discontinuity in Malta and some European countries between the achievement of girls, which is good, and at the moment in most countries of the OECD, actually girls outperform boys. So it doesn't look as if the main problem for take-up in certain subject areas is to do with achievement, but it's more to do with other aspects, which we can discuss. But if I go back to the question of the ex-Soviet countries and the Eastern Bloc, because they offered this good quality education in all these subjects, they had high expectations for females as well as for males. They made it clear that it was appropriate. They had a lot of female scientists. So this is, I'm saying this, it's a caveat, a warning, that we must be aware that things change and schools change. Another example I can give you, about 15 years ago, following the introduction of co-education in secondary schools in many Western countries that didn't previously have it, feminists began to realize that co-education wasn't necessarily benefiting girls in the way that they thought. They had originally argued in favor of co-education, so that girls will have the access to the same resources boys did, the same labs, for example, the same well-qualified teachers, the same hours of learning a subject. You might consider, but didn't they? Well, even if I think back, of course, it's a long time ago, my own education. My brothers did many more hours of science at school. They had a lesson every day than I did. So obviously they did better, you know. So even things like that. So when feminists first argued for co-ed, they thought it would benefit girls. They then began to find there were various factors which were not allowing girls to actually do as well in the co-ed setting. Some of it was to do with masculinities and femininities, teenagers who are trying still to assert a gender identity, either a femininity or a masculinity, will want to seem different to the opposite sex. So it seemed as if co-ed was actually aggravating this desire to be different. And it's one of the things that has caused me to be very concerned about Malta recently, when we did in 2014 move to state secondary co-ed education, because if doing it without a plan for gender equality could lead to problems of segregation and separation, what we would mean would be that young people, young females, would not choose a subject because more boys are taking it, or the other way around, because it's a problem for boys too. And in fact, at the moment, I'm having a look at some of the SEC reports about the MatSEC exam reports about take up, who takes what subject, all right? And I am seeing quite a lot of gender segregation. So they're taking different subjects, which does seem to be getting a bit worse in some subjects than it was before the co-ed. So it's something that one would explore. So I'm talking about this to sort of make the listeners aware that the context in which children learn, the social context, the parents, of course, are an important influence as well. But the social context is very important in gender differences in education. And therefore, our response has to be in line with what is happening here. I can't just take something that is being tried somewhere else if the context is different. I have to look at where it is being applied, an intervention, for example, to increase the participation of females in STEM subjects is one of them, or to raise the achievement of boys, which currently is quite a few points below girls. Then I have to first know my context. It's no good doing it without knowing the context.
It is an interesting point, this, that which subjects the girls choose and which subjects also the boys choose, because although this series has been emphasizing the females,
yes,
there's also I had a very interesting discussion with François Mussoul
about
education and seeing why there isn't a bigger take up of males within the Faculty of Education, and you know, was it necessary? Are we missing something? What are the reasons for it?
And we won't be missing anything if the take up of males is of males who are macho masculine. So, because those type of males in teaching would give the boys an idea of a masculinity which is very outdated and not productive for them. So we have to be a bit careful with this argument.
Yes.
I heard it said somewhere else about, oh, well, there aren't enough males in teaching. But let's be careful who the males are.
And some of the issues also of, you mentioned the kind of careers that the girls want to go into.
Yes, yes.
Are dependent on certain cultural mores well that have also, I think, hung on from previous years, say decades, and somehow things have moved on in many ways, but somehow the social mores maybe haven't had such a rapid catch-up.
There is that, but I don't think it's only that, because if you actually look at the labour market, and this is something which I feel guidance, careers guidance people need to know much more about the labour market, and I don't think that they do. And that is, they need to be looking at, in different sectors, what are the working conditions, what are the hours, how much flexibility is there, the work-life balance, what is the wage gap, the gender wage gap, because young people do know a lot about the labour market, more than we think, and they know how work is organised. Sometimes they don't know enough, so there might be new industries where it would be very helpful, and some of the interventions are about getting them to know about these industries, and some shadowing, some chance to try on, so to speak, what it's like to be in an occupation, even if you didn't go to the industry itself and do the shadowing or take up an apprenticeship, you could have a camp or a fair where people, females, in the case of females, because we're promoting female interest in a wide range of occupations, would prepare things that the girls can do to know what it's like to be in this role, have this responsibility. But if we do look at the labor market, there is a lot of sexism in the labor market. There's a lot of gender segregation in the labor market, who's doing what, and separation. By separation, you could be in the same sector, for example, teaching, but you're doing different things. So even if we look at teaching, why is it with over 70% female teachers, the majority of heads are male? There's a discriminatory process that is somehow giving promotions to those people. So there, if we want the young girls and women to know about sectors, we need to actually tell these industries, we'd like to send you our students, but if you need to show us that you are gender equitable. I want to see your loos, your bathrooms. Do you have clean female-only bathrooms or not? Do you have flexi time? Do you have family work balance? Do you have maternity leave? What is the pay gap? Because young people do know. So knowing more about that and the guidance people actually finding out and finding places of work where if a female goes, there are other females, role models. UNESCO has a very interesting report, a brilliant literature review of the last few years. It was published in 2017 on girls and STEM. And one of the main things that keeps coming up was the importance of role models, which includes schools actively recruiting. You mentioned recruiting male teachers as role models, which I put in brackets, but let's make sure that they are not modeling macho masculinity. But there's the same need to recruit female teachers for maths and sciences and to make sure that each school, so when we deploy teachers, that each secondary school has the teaching staff in those areas a good balance, and that balance isn't as used to be in the past. The females teach Form 1 and Form 2, coordinated science it used to be called, and then the males teach the sort of harder disciplines of the separate physics, chemistry, biology. If you want to model to girls that they can belong and have an identity in science, technology, engineering, mathematics, then you have to definitely invest in capacity building of female teachers, which includes capacity building of primary school teachers who are mainly female in mathematics, because one of the big problems for both boys and girls is not feeling competent, and the feelings of not having competence appear to work much less in the they work better for boys. Boys have more confidence even when they shouldn't actually have it. But it helps them learn, because if you have confidence, you are more ready to take a risk. And a lot of new learning is, of course, based on risk-taking. I'll try something out. It doesn't matter if I make a mistake. So some of the interventions are based on, firstly, the capacity building of primary school female teachers in mathematics, so they themselves feel confident and transmit the confidence to their pupils, whether they are male or female. But also to build up a girl's confidence from primary school and their sense of belonging in the sciences, technology, engineering, and mathematics. So to have activities, even out of school activities, where they do things hands-on, in based all the best methods of teaching these subjects, which make them feel they can acquire an identity as a scientist, and to also help them with self-confidence in general. And one of the things we find is that teachers don't give very accurate feedback when someone is doing the work, especially to girls, and girls need prescriptive feedback. You know, which bit did I actually do wrong? How can I think it through to do it right? And a belief that you have the ability to do it. So that needs to be really fostered a lot, the self-efficacy. I mean, we see it working at an individual level. If we had to see the factors that lead to difference, we would separate individual level, family and peer, school-based level, social, societal level. But self-efficacy, although it's to do with the individual, your belief in your own competence. Of course, it is social, how much other people believe in your competence and what opportunities do they give you to actually work things out. So again, the interventions would include better feedback, more time to work with mathematics, for example, more time to work at it and to revise mistakes, accurate information about mistakes. Sometimes teachers feel, oh, I can't tell that girl because she's oversensitive, that she's not doing well. But we have found that when you say accurately, yes, but look, you seem to be stuck here. Do you want to try working on this again? What do you think the problem is? They do better and feel more confident.
They feel they're being taken seriously.
Yes. So that would be sort of at the classroom level, and you can see how these work together.
Another thing that struck me as I was talking to people over the weeks, in the beginning, of course, there was a limited amount of courses. It was medicine, perhaps it was B.Lit at the beginning, then B.A., and then it was Ph.C., a lot of pharmaceutical chemists. Those were the main areas, the professions, and Ph.C. was very popular because it was always considered the go-to degree for women. Things have obviously changed enormously. Life has, the work life has changed, the opportunities, the technology has changed. And somehow, perhaps the ideas of the curriculum have remained a solid base in mathematics, a solid base in history, hopefully in geography, though I don't know about that. Uh-huh. And that perhaps the breadth of possibilities is not being put across to the students, and they need to have that breadth to be able to make better choices, perhaps.
Actually, I'm not so sure that's happening, and I am more worried that the core curriculum, what things that should be core, you mentioned history and geography, are no longer core, and I think it's a very big problem not to have them as core. And we have had new subjects being introduced, media and digital technology, the vocational subjects are being introduced, but I think, and from the research that I've seen in many countries, we are introducing them at too younger age. They are choosing at form two. And when they choose, you then close off opportunities. And also the choice at form two tends to be very much based on performance. So the teachers will be telling them, oh, you're not doing very well. So, for example, someone who mightn't be doing that well in coordinated general science, but with some help could be better, could be pushed into taking biology and chemistry, and then eventually can choose whether she wants to do medicine, nursing, biomedical sciences, but instead is pushed into the vocational stream. And that is happening too early. In most countries, this is postponed, at least beyond 14, often beyond 16. And you would get better results if you postpone it. And again, you can have a broader curriculum to know that there are different subjects and different ways of learning, but to have it, you cannot have this such a demanding coverage-based, we would call it, covering everything at 16, which doesn't really make sense, because sometimes the things that they're doing, they come to university in the first year, and they're just doing things they did at sixth form, even in the last year of SEC,
I was thinking perhaps of introducing certain subjects or certain possible careers in a very basic way, even to perhaps primary school
children. Definitely. That would be, again, the intervention programs would make the connection between what you are learning and real life. And this is one of the key things, well, for girls especially, but actually it seems to work even for boys, that seeing the connection with what you are learning now and its application. And I'm not saying that you teach it in a very instrumental way. In other words, you don't necessarily say, I'll only teach you what you need to do if you're doing that, or how you would use it today that you are 7 years old? No. But to show you, by learning what you're learning today when you are seven, this is what someone who is working on this would work when they are 30. you know, and that those types of interventions, so making that connection, having posters showing people in the occupation fields, making sure you have female representation, of course, inviting guests, and all of that helps. So, and certainly for girls and the area in which there is a discontinuity, because we have to make it clear that at the moment for girls, it isn't a problem of achievement, although for some girls, especially disadvantaged girls, they are not achieving as well in education as they should do. And the achievement gap between children of different social backgrounds is much bigger than the achievement gap between males and females. So it's something that should worry us much more. But one of the things that we know is that up until the level of SEC, so 16, girls are actually taking up sciences much more than boys. If you look at the take-up of, I have the 2018, taking up three sciences, 17.5% of all girls born in the year of the cohort turned 16, 17.5 took three sciences, all right, compared to only 13% of boys. And there's always been a gap, but it's growing in favor of girls. All right. Two sciences, 13.4% of the girls took two, only 10% of the boys. One, so the one that you have to have, that's when the boys then took more. But it means they didn't take two, they didn't take three. So what is happening is there's a discontinuity in take-up. Of course, 17% and 13% for three is low compared to other European countries. You know, why isn't everyone doing them? It's a problem with the curriculum itself. But what I mean to say is what we would need to look at more is, you know, what girls are learning about the workplace, what parents know about opportunities in these sectors. So some of the suggestions for intervention would be from an early age, parents who have daughters who are young, start giving them information about, if you know, this subject, what it requires, what types of jobs you could do. As the child gets older, you can tell the parent and the child more about the conditions in the labour market. But it does mean that schools have to work more closely with people in the labour market. Yes.
Definitely. I mean, looking at my own particular pet subject, archaeology, of course.
Yes.
It's not a subject that's taught at school, and yet for especially a context like Malta, it's so important that people, everybody should know about archaeology, but somehow that message perhaps is not getting across. Yes. Anyway, unbelievably, we have come to the end of this programme. I would have loved to have gone chatting about this for
And chatting about archaeology.
Yes.
Even more interesting.
Yeah, that's my favourite.
Yes.
And I'd just like to thank you, Professor Mary Darmanin, for being with us today. Very sweet of you to take time out to be with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to 100 Years of Women on Campus. If you would like to hear the programs again, just go to www.maltauniversitybroadcasting.com and click on webcasts. Join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye. You have just listened to 100 Years of Women on Campus, produced and presented by Patricia Camilleri.